From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Once again this week, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld was at pains to reassure the world about the Pentagon's commitment to truth.
Government officials, the Department of Defense, this secretary and the people that work with me, tell the American people and the people of the world the truth.
That promise set some eyes to rolling, considering the government's checkered history of deception in the Vietnam War, for example, even though earlier in the century the government aired dramatizations to inoculate the public against Nazi lies.
Did you know there's ground glass in all the surgical sponges in the Army?
Girls with needles under their nails been working in the gas mask factories and been puncturing the masks.
You know what I overheard at lunch? A ship with 5,000 bodies from Pearl Harbor arrived in New York.
What prompted Rumsfeld's declaration, though, was a fresh revelation. According to the New York Times, the Pentagon, frustrated by America's poor showing in the propaganda war, is considering a campaign in which it would plant false information in foreign newspapers. Joining us to discuss such a scenario is Paul McMasters, First Amendment Ombudsman at the Freedom Forum. Paul, welcome to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Now, look, I've known you for many years, and I know I don't even have to interview you on this subject. I'm just going to interrupt you periodically to squeeze some more lighter fluid on the fire. The Defense Department planting disinformation in foreign media. Go.
Well, I think there's a number of reasons to be concerned about this. Obviously, we all know that the disinformation has been an instrument of foreign policy and military operations since the beginning of our times, and we're not the only ones that practice it. I think in this situation, though, we're seeing a ratcheting up of that as a policy and an interesting placing of it in an office in the Pentagon rather than in the intelligence agencies or, say, out of the State Department.
Let's talk about the credibility of the United States for a moment. The U.S. is always at pains with foreign audiences to persuade them that it is speaking the truth. What effect do you suppose it will have, irrespective of whether this program ever is carried forward, on the credibility of all messages from the United States to audiences, domestic and foreign?
Where I am primarily concerned about this is what it does to the credibility of the press and its ability to provide an independent and credible source of information to the American people. If the people don't know whether to trust the information they're getting, either from their elected leaders or their unelected press, then that really confuses the democratic process.
Paul, what precipitates this, it appears, is America's frustration at trying to get its message across to audiences in the Arab and Muslim worlds. These are audiences that are accustomed to dealing with media sources that are heavily controlled by repressive governments. Should the government fight fire with fire?
Every war is different than the preceding war, but this one more so than any other. And it is very tempting to, if we can adopt the military methods and tactics that our enemies are using, why not their informational tactics? I think in the long run, however, it compromises so many things that we stand for that there can be nothing but harm, not only to the credibility of our officials, but the ability of the American citizens to fully understand, support, and or challenge policies that come out of Washington.
Whatever happens now with this initiative or proposed initiative, isn't the damage already done?
Well, I think that certainly can be argued, especially if you take it in this context. We have seen from the very beginning a conscious or an unconscious, and I would like to think that it was an unintentional, compromising of the American press by administrative policies. We saw the calls from the White House to the major networks and newspapers about how they should cover interviews with Osama bin Laden. We heard the ominous warning from the White House spokesman about Americans should watch what they say. I think this proposal would do even more damage in the ability of the American press to get an independent source of information and therefore better evaluate what is going on in this very important war on terrorism.
But even if the Defense Department says, oh, no, no, this was just talk, we discussed it, forget all about it, we would never do such a thing, this is off the table, is there really anyone who believes that it will truly be off the table?
Well, I think that there will be some who will take the Defense Department at its word here, but we must keep in mind that on several occasions, the Secretary of Defense has said to the American people through the press briefings that he would not, nor any of his people, lie directly to the American people. Is that the truth, or is that a part of the campaign would be a question that would come to many people's minds?
Well, Paul, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Paul McMasters is a First Amendment ombudsman at the Freedom Forum in Washington, D.C.
The U.S. government's media war against terrorism has a new weapon, pop radio. Norman Pattis of Westwood One, one of the nation's largest distributors of commercial radio programming, has been enlisted to create a new radio network that will spread the gospel of American values and pop culture all the way from Cyprus to Djibouti. The target audience is people under 25, who make up 60% of the population of the Middle East. Norman Pattis joins me now, and he's brought along an English language demo tape. We'll play some of the clips, and you can be the judge. Norman Pattis, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So you've been quoted as calling this project the new station for the new generation. You make it sound a little like an MTV spinoff.
Well, it's not an MTV spinoff, you know, in the strictest sense, but it does have some of the same qualities, since this is a radio broadcasting service that's targeted primarily to the 25 and under audience. We want to use the kinds of tools that we know work in attracting that audience to build the largest possible following that we can. So we'll be using a mix of Arabic and Western pop music to deliver the 25 and under audience to our news and to our messages of public diplomacy.
What sorts of research have you done?
We've done focus groups in Cairo, in Amman, in the Gulf. And the kinds of things that they want on that radio station are things like features on marriage, features on health, features on finance, features on computers and the internet, the kinds of features that you would expect an audience of 25 and under to be interested in just about any part of the globe.
Hey, coming up in the next hour, along with a lot of great music, of course, you'll hear some of our listeners' answers to the question of the day, a roundup of American editorial opinion, plus a rundown on what's happening in clubs and concerts this week all across the region. And tonight at 10, don't miss U.S. Policy Roundtable, a lively exchange of opinions from experts in Washington and the Middle East.
You'll be presenting a mix of Middle Eastern music and American pop music. What sorts of Middle Eastern music and what sorts of American pop artists have you discovered in your research do translate well over there?
We're finding that the Arabic pop and the Western pop blend very, very well. You know, artists like Hakim and Khalid in the Middle East blend very well with artists like Britney Spears and New Kids on the Block.
Egyptian singing star George Wasouf and Kalema Ness, People Talk. Before that, we heard New Kids on the Block, Iraqi singing star Kadama Saher, and we started things off for you with Desert Rose from Sting and Cheb Mami. I'm Sylvia, and I'll be back with a really inspiring song from the one and only Mariah Carey right after we check the latest.
It's interesting that you talk about Britney Spears and the New Kids on the Block, but you never mentioned rap music, and you'd expect that rap would resonate in lands where there are so many young people and so much anger.
Well, that may very well be the case, that some of that might make its way in. By the same token, you know, to be realistic about this, we've got to do a bit of a kabuki dance here. We're operating in some areas on FM frequencies that we'll be getting through agreements with the local governments. We're not interested, you know, in destabilizing moderate Arab governments by putting on,
Puff Daddy?
You know, not necessarily Puff Daddy, but a lot of stuff that's criticized heavily right here in the United States.
Destabilize the governments or destabilize your relationship with the governments?
I think that there'll be less objection to our music than there may be objection to the kind of open and free dialogue, the example of a free press in the American tradition. Those are probably the things that are going to irritate some members of local governments than the music that we play.
I Want to Know. Authoritative answers to your questions from experts all over the world. This question comes to us from Muhammad in Cairo. He says, I want to know why the U.S. is fighting a war against Islam. Well, Muhammad, perhaps the best expert to respond to your question is President Bush. In his speech to the U.S. Congress on September 20th, he said that the U.S. is not fighting a war against Islam, but against terrorists. And he addressed these words directly to Muslims all over the world.
We respect your faith. It's practiced freely by many millions of Americans and by millions more in countries that America counts as friends.
Well, let's talk about some of the news and information content then, getting beyond marriage and dating shows and personal finance. You'll be producing news, and you'll be producing news by local people, but under the direction of people in the United States to some extent. How close is this to propaganda?
It's not propaganda at all. I am a governor on the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors, which oversees all of our international broadcasting services, Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Asia, the Maltese, and several other services.
Every hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as news happens, News of the Moment brings you the straight story, direct from our comprehensive network of experienced correspondents around the world.
Paula Wolfson, the White House.
Alex Valido, the Pentagon.
Scott Bobb, Bangkok.
Ayaz Gul, Islamabad.
Leita Hong Fincher, Beijing.
Luis Ramirez, Abby Jones.
Linda Cashton, Washington.
But when you talk about the Radio Maltese and the Radio Liberties and so on, those clearly are restricted in areas, and we've heard complaints from them and about them during our war on terror, in that some of their reporting has been circumscribed. These are not necessarily paragons of the most open kind of information that will also provide dissenting voices to American policy.
Well, you know, that's in the ear of the beholder. I mean, all one has to do is listen to NPR, Fox, and CNN cover the same story to realize that you might get a different take from all three of those right here in the United States. Our mission is quite simply to promote freedom and democracy through the free flow of accurate, reliable, and credible news and information about America and the world to audiences overseas.
Well, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Norman Pattiz is chairman of Westwood One, and as a member of the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors, is a prime mover behind the Middle Eastern Radio Network, set to launch in about a month.
It's a beautiful sunny afternoon all across the region. Hi there, I'm Sylvia, and I've got one of the biggest hits for you of the year 2000. It's a collaboration between the English singer Sting and Algerian rye star Cheb Mami, a song they sang at a concert together in Tunis just this past April. Here you go, here's Desert Rose.
Coming up, the courts hand big media a big win, and we rip the shroud of secrecy off of the World Business Review.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the axe that consumer advocates kept warning us about finally fell on a couple of FCC regulations written decades ago. A federal court in Washington ruled that it's okay for cable systems and TV stations in the same market to buy each other up. It also said that the FCC must reconsider the rule that says no one company's TV stations can reach more than 35% of the nation's households. It's anticipated that the next regulation to go up on the chopping block will be the one that bars broadcasters and newspapers in the same market from owning each other. Essentially, the court and its broadcast plaintiffs say that these measures to protect diversity are outdated in such a crowded media market. Chris Murray, a lawyer for the Consumers Union, is worried.
In any community, most people get their information from two sources, either the broadcaster or the cable company. Imagine if these news services start buying each other up.
Are you absolutely convinced that stories and ideas will be suppressed if the owners become bigger?
It's not so much just if the owners become bigger. The question is, if the owners have sort of an increasing web of relationships between each other, and they have joint ventures, they have joint programming agreements, and aggressively covering each other becomes sort of economically dangerous for them, I think that's where the viewpoints get suppressed.
Now, the court, strictly speaking, didn't overturn the cap that says no one broadcaster can reach more than 35% of the country with the stations it owns. It sent that back to the FCC, and the FCC is expected to come up with, say, a 50% cap or something like that. Does it really matter?
Well, you're exactly correct that it's been sent back to the FCC, but the political reality is that the Federal Communications Commission under Michael Powell is going to either get rid of this rule entirely or raise the cap to such a level that the local affiliates really go away. And the marketplace result to that is that local news goes away because it's incredibly expensive to produce. It's much more efficient to just put in Buffy the Vampire Slayer all over the country.
How would you counter the objections of the industry that have said, listen, we have so much more diversity now than we did when these rules were promulgated, when there were only three networks, when you have 100 channels, satellite, cable, the internet, and so forth, adding to the general cacophony?
We have to talk about the difference between variety and diversity of ownership. It's one thing to have 70 channels. But if those 70 channels or 100 channels are all owned by the same person or by three or four companies, to me, that's not real diversity.
So do you see this as just falling dominoes, all of these protections that were put in place so many years ago, dropping one by one?
Well, we are absolutely in free-fall mode with regard to media ownership restrictions, whether it's the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rule going away, this particular broadcast cable cross-ownership rule going away, the 35% broadcast cap, all of these sort of seemingly Byzantine, slightly boring regulations, as they go away all at once, it's amazing the consolidation effects that we're going to see. For instance, in the internet, we always hear, you know, well, if you can't get diverse news and information over broadcast television, just go to the internet. 30% of all user minutes last year were spent in one company's website, and that was AOL Time Warner. We always think, well, the internet can't really get consolidated, but it's happening there as well.
Chris Murray, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Chris Murray is a lawyer for the Consumers Union. Steve Efros joins us now. For 23 years, he was the head of the Cable Telecommunications Association, one of the major national trade associations for the cable television industry. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you were one of the people who actually wrote these laws back in your FCC days in the 70s. Why were
That's
they
right.
apropos then, but not now?
The concern back then was when there was a nascent industry such as cable, that a broadcaster could buy the cable franchise and then not build it. That no longer is an issue because the cable systems are built. There was also a concern that a cable company could buy a broadcast station and then only carry that broadcast station. But there are now rules that prohibit that, so they have to carry all the broadcast stations anyway. The two principal concerns, legally, were eliminated by the passage of time and the passage of other rules and regulations. The third one, with regard to diversity, has obviously changed. Back 30 years ago, we had, you know, three major networks and several independents maybe in major markets and a public broadcast station. Now we have hundreds of stations. And so those were the primary concerns. They're no longer concerns. The court said this is anachronistic.
Well, then tell me, why do you think that consumer advocates are so passionate about this?
I'm not sure.
I think because they see it as the first or perhaps the fourth or fifth of a series of a dozen dominoes that are dropping all the protections of the public interest in the broadcast realm that were established by the FCC when you were there writing them.
The public interest in the broadcast realm. But what that does is make the assumption that big is bad.
And you don't think big is bad?
I don't think there's very much support for the proposition, no. I think that we got more news when CNN had enough money to do news. They couldn't do it when they were small. So, no, big is not necessarily bad. I just don't buy that premise. If CNN were the only one, then I buy the premise. But we have antitrust laws for that. There are a whole other set of laws in this country that are there to deal with the question of monopoly. And those haven't been touched. So I'm still not sure why there is this feeling that the sky is falling. I don't think the sky is falling.
when you see some other age-old regulations going under the axe, like the 35% cap or the mm-hmm. upcoming probable repeal of the newspaper broadcast cross-ownership rules, do any of these give you cause for concern?
I think there's cause for being very pleased that the system has worked, because what the courts are saying is it seems to us that we have more diversity today than we've ever had. We have more different points of view being heard than we ever had. And therefore, the rules that you were talking about, which were established in an era when we didn't have that diversity, are no longer needed. I think that's a good thing.
Okay. Steve, thank you very much.
All righty. Anytime.
Steve Efros is president of Efros Communications, a strategic communications and consulting firm. It shows up on public broadcasting stations. It trumpets its connections with famous universities, and its hosts are world-famous former top government officials. But the twice-a-week program titled World Business Review is not the news magazine it claims to be. In fact, in a media world where the lines between advertising and programming are increasingly blurred, World Business Review has more than once had to defend against journalistic questions about whether it really is a program at all. Bob wondered, too, and after 9 months of poking around, concluded that what amounts to a 30-minute commercial may be running on a public TV station near you.
Welcome to World Business Review. I'm Alexander Haig. Our next topic involves solutions in the field of electronic messaging. Here for this discussion is Bill Long, chairman and CEO of EC Bridges.
Yes, that's the Al Haig, former Secretary of State, former White House Chief of Staff, retired four-star general, and lately, it would appear, inquiring TV journalist. Following in the footsteps of fellow Reagan administration appointee Caspar Weinberger, Haig is the host of World Business Review, which boasts that it is award-winning educational fare. Here's the general in a typically hard-hitting WBR interview.
Now, Jim, how does an EDI solution enhance a company's ROI?
Tremendously. Because you have the ability...
Still, according to its producers, Florida's Multimedia Productions, WBR reaches approximately 50 million American homes. There's an asterisk next to the 50 million homes figure, and if you look farther, you see the figure qualified as potential. That means WBR shows up at some point during the broadcast week on one or another channels which are available, cumulatively, in 50 million households. It doesn't mean gigantic audiences are tuning in. Common practice, small matter. But the more you dig into World Business Review, you realize that its promotional materials could use a whole lot more asterisks. Take, for example, the claim that...
The following colleges and universities offer World Business Review as a course, course supplement, or through their library systems.
Under the headline about a full semester curriculum developed by Indiana State University's Professor Gerald Cockrell, WBR's website recently listed 40 institutions of higher education employing the show for educational purposes. Well, yes and no.
They don't really have a connection with Duke University like they claim.
Jim Gray is Associate Dean of the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University.
We saw World Business Review's use of our logo and name as unauthorized exploitation of our brand. When we found out what they were doing, we asked them, in no uncertain terms, to cease and desist. What they did was they sent us tapes and was pretty savvy in getting us to sign an acceptance of those tapes, which merely said, yes, we'll take the tapes and we'll put them in a library. And nobody ever checks those out, that's for sure, and we've stopped having them in a library.
Shortly after we began making inquiries, Duke's name was pulled off of WBR's website, but 39 others remained. Among them, we located 12 institutions where a professor or two keep the tapes in classrooms as supplemental materials. One of them is Indiana State's Professor Cockrell, who is on WBR's advisory board. Cockrell told us he likes how WBR stays on the cutting edge of technology long after traditional texts become outdated. But according to university spokeswoman Teresa Exline, even he doesn't use the tapes as a formal part of the curriculum.
He's not using this as curriculum either. He uses the videos in his classroom to supplement a full-fledged curriculum.
Several universities told us the tapes are seldom, if ever, checked out, but the producers are keen to keep them stacked on library shelves. An official at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh told us that when they tried to unsubscribe from WBR, they didn't even get return phone calls. Maybe that's because WBR thrives on a delicately balanced ecosystem of borrowed prestige, in which the appearance of broad university affiliations, General Haig's international stature, and public television's mission are inextricably linked. But if the college connection is problematic, the public TV one is even more so.
They have a very slick operation.
Stan Marvin is program director at KRCB-TV, a PBS affiliate north of San Francisco.
And I was a little wowed by the fact that, gee, we could have these guys on our TV station. Woo-hoo, it doesn't cost us anything to have Casper Weinberger or Alexander Haig MC a program or host a program on our station.
KRCB no longer carries the program. The decision to drop it came after Stan Marvin became suspicious by just how un-Mike Wallace-like General Haig's questioning was. He says he telephoned his WBR contact and asked her to disclose the relationship between the interviewers and the interviewees.
She didn't want to tell me everything. And I asked straight on, do the people that I'm watching on your program pay to be on your program? Because that's a no-no. And she didn't answer me. She sort of just danced around the question. And that was enough for me.
That's because, according to the FCC, public stations are prohibited by the amended Communications Act of 1934 from carrying advertising for for-profit entities. But when KRCB's traffic manager tried to cancel the show, Marvin says,
she got extremely irate with him and threatened all kinds of things. Don't mess with the general. That's the quote.
As it turns out, WBR story subjects are almost always paying customers. They pay a so-called underwriting fee for their companies to be featured, a fee up to $50,000, to WBR's advisory board, called the Alliance for Technology Education. More on the alliance shortly. But any time an interview subject is paying anything to appear, the relationship ceases to be journalism, which may explain questions like this.
Dennis, how difficult is it for a merchant to set up a contactless smart card reader? Is it expensive?
No, the readers are actually a few hundred dollars, so the price is not prohibitive. And actually,
Dennis Ryan is president of Amatech, whose feature on World Business Review included not only friendly questions from General Haig, but also a testimonial from a satisfied Amatech customer. All in all, to use Ryan's phrase, good bang for the buck.
It was not blatant advertising for Amatech. They actually asked some questions that we didn't give them. So from that standpoint, they did get spontaneity.
They weren't argumentative questions.
Absolutely not.
The producers of World Business Review repeatedly declined to make General Haig or anyone else from the organization available to be interviewed on tape, but CEO and executive producer Thomas Kleins sent correspondence arguing that appearance fees are just a means of creative financing for a worthwhile program, that the producers retain editorial control, and that the shows have clear disclaimers disclosing a financial relationship with the companies being profiled. That disclaimer, which describes the sponsorships as funding of production costs, is on screen in the final credits for 8 to 12 seconds. In actuality, most of the stations we contacted, including a Hillsborough County, Florida cable access outlet grandly called the Education Channel, expressed surprise at the financial relationship. Lucy Griggs is the program director at the Education Channel.
Now, I didn't realize that it was actually a fee that they had to pay to be on. Their website shows in their credits, I think, too, that you know they have sponsorships from businesses, but it's not elucidated.
That financial relationship is further clouded by that other entity, the Alliance for Technology Education. According to those we interviewed, clients who appear on WBR pay their appearance fees not to the production company, but to the Alliance, which in turn underwrites the overall series. According to Larry Holden, who at the time was program director at WSBE in Providence, Rhode Island, this layer of separation was created in 1997 following objections from stations about the direct funding. In his phrasing, the alliance is a slush fund.
They established a fund, and corporations and other funders would be able to contribute to the fund, but were not dictating or paying for the individual programs that might have a particular executive of a particular company appearing on the program. So there was a layer of isolation.
That layer cleanses not only client fees coming in, but also money going out. FCC rules prohibit public stations from selling their airtime, but the alliance has bestowed grants to underwrite WBR on at least 7 of the public TV stations. The Alliance for Technology Education may have a nonprofit-sounding name, but it is registered with the Florida Secretary of State as a for-profit corporation, listing World Business Review boss Thomas Kleins as principal officer. Station executive Larry Holden.
Neither of us were born yesterday. I think that they believed that this would help the station continue to broadcast the program.
With the juice man himself, Jay Cordage.
Hi, I'm Jay Cordage. You know me as the juice man. Today, I want to show you the power of juicing. I want to show you how important...
Infomercials have their rightful place in the commercial television food chain, so long as there is no misdirection about what's going on. World Business Review airs on PBS stations amid all sorts of misdirection. For the stations, for the universities whose names and logos it bandies about, and most of all, no matter how cleverly the elements are arranged and obscured, for the public. The public, then, might be wondering about the producer's boast that WBR is an award-winning program. That it is. It has won what it calls the coveted Telly and Aegis Awards, both heavily geared toward commercials and corporate video production. Among the other honorees when WBR received its trophies, the National Ready Mixed Concrete Association and West Valley High School.
Coming up, media confusion over the Olympics. Is it news or melodrama? It's a rhetorical question.
This is On the Media from National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Watching the local news each night or any of the sports highlight shows, you'll always find the day's sports highlights. The great shot, the winning homer, the fatal NASCAR crash, and so forth. So conspicuous by their absence for the past 2 weeks, at least on non-NBC affiliates, are highlights from the Olympic Games in Salt Lake City. Joining us now to explain the Olympic news blackout is David Wittenstein, an intellectual property lawyer with Dow, Lonis, and Albertson in Washington, D.C. Mr. Wittenstein, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much.
Now, I don't watch much prime time, but I do watch a lot of news. And in the past 2 weeks, I have seen a lot of baseball players stretching in Florida, a lot of college basketball highlights, and almost no ski jumping. What's the deal?
NBC sends out to all of the TV stations in the country something it calls news access guidelines that tells them how much they can take and when they can show it. And it's pretty restrictive because NBC doesn't want to see its big investment diluted by having ABC and CBS and Fox and everybody else covering the games just the way you're seeing it on NBC affiliates.
How can they govern how the media covers news events? Isn't there a fair use doctrine which permits news organizations to run otherwise copyrighted material if there's a genuine news value?
There certainly is. And the problem with sports in particular is that there's really only been one reported case on fair use of sports highlights. The case is about 20 years old, and it suggests that there is very limited, if any, fair use for sports highlights.
Well, if that's the only court precedent, is there some sort of gentleman's agreement that allows networks to share the clips that they obviously share now?
Yes, absolutely. And lots of networks do have sharing arrangements. But otherwise, a lot of the limits that are placed on how much is shared really are through these news access guidelines.
Considering there's only one 20-year-old case on this legal question, and considering that the networks more or less conspiratorially ignore the ruling in that case and have been for decades, Why do you suppose that nobody has straightforwardly challenged the decision, or at least tried to create some new law by testing the waters in this area and running, say, NBC's figure skating footage against NBC's will?
You know, it's a risk against a well-heeled copyright plaintiff that has spent a lot of money and has every incentive to pursue an infringement claim very vigorously. I actually happen to believe that there have been enough developments in the law about how news uses are favored and preferred types of uses that I think you'd have a good fighting chance. The case that's the 20-year-old case takes the position, for example, that almost by definition, something that you want to show on your news program that's a highlight is by definition so qualitatively important because it's a highlight that it can't constitute fair use. Well, that doesn't make any sense.
And here's Wally Bruckner with the parts of the game that you really wouldn't have cared to see.
Precisely. You could probably be allowed to show the things that nobody wants to see.
Oh, like the Jeff Greenfield show. No need to comment. David Wittenstein, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
David Wittenstein is a partner with the law firm Dow, Lonis, and Albertson in Washington, D.C.
If you know nothing else about the Winter Olympics, you know that 16-year-old Sarah Hughes leaped up from fourth place to capture the gold. Figure skating is one of the most popular of the Winter Games, or at least the one most fraught with emotion. One of the reasons is the way the media portray the competitors as characters in a melodrama.
They are the princesses of figure skating. And tonight, four women will take the ice looking to join that list of legends. A 23-year-old Russian who rediscovered her love for the sport. Two teenagers looking to burst out of the shadows and into the spotlight. And one skating icon, hoping to prove that she can win on her own terms.
Abigail Federkane has frequently written on the subject of figure skaters and the media, and she says the drama fuels the passion for the sport.
It's important to remember that other than a group of very attached core audience members, most people don't follow skating very closely. So every 4 years, they have to be given a reason to watch, a reason to care. And that's why I think these narratives, these stories that are constructed around the skating are as important and as fascinating to study as the events themselves.
So describe some of those narratives. What have we become accustomed to over the years?
I think for a long time, the standard narrative was the conflict of the Cold War, was East versus West. When the Eastern Bloc began to break down, the first big conflict that we got in ladies' figure skating was the idea of athletes versus artists. And there was a period of time when the difficulty in the programs the women were doing was almost as difficult as what the men were doing. And there was a lot of discomfort with that. Should the women be doing these triple jumps? Would skating just become a jump fest? Was it losing its artistry and therefore losing its appeal?
Is that why we had Nancy Kerrigan, graceful lady, and Tanya Harding, athletic, aggressive? What was the name? Tough Cookie, they
called
her?
Absolutely, the Tough Cookie. And long before 1994 and the famous whack on the knee, there was always a dichotomy set up between Kerrigan and Harding, and in fact between two other champions, Christy Yamaguchi, who won the gold in 92, and Midori Ito of Japan. Ito and Harding had both performed the triple axel jump successfully in competition. They were the only two women who had done it. Kerrigan and Yamaguchi had not performed that jump, although they each had their share of athleticism and performed plenty of triples. But it was just easier to set them up as the artists versus the athletes.
There's another scenario I seem to remember. It's the up from adversity scenario. I remember a Ukrainian skater from about 8 years ago, Oksana Bayul, whose mother had died, whose life was so miserable.
The Bayul story is especially interesting because you may or may not remember, but that came on the tail end of the whole Nancy Kerrigan, Tanya Harding drama. So you had Nancy Kerrigan and Tanya Harding going into these Olympics, and not many people seemed to be paying much attention to the fact that Oksana Bayul was actually the reigning world champion. She had won the world championship in 1993. When you actually got to the Olympics and it became clear after the short program that Harding was not going to be in contention, then suddenly Bayul's story began to emerge. And lo and behold, her overcoming adversity story was a lot more touching and a lot more dramatic than Nancy Kerrigan's overcoming her knee injury. So in that case, there was one narrative going into the games, the conflict narrative, the good girl, bad girl narrative. There was another narrative that emerged, Nancy Kerrigan overcoming the adversity of her injury. And there was a final narrative that became predominant, Oksana Bayul overcoming the adversity of an entire life.
So what have we seen in this Olympics? What story has prevailed, or are we actually hearing bits of all of those scenarios?
Nobody seems to be able to decide what the best story is. There's a little bit of Cold War redux here. The showdown between Russia's Irina Slutskaya and American Michelle Kwan, which is a long-standing rivalry. And in fact, in the Canadian and French papers, that's the predominant story. The American media, I think, missed Tanya and Nancy to a large extent and was looking for a conflict, was looking for another bad girl. And for a few moments there in late January, early February, it looked as if they had identified Sasha Cohen as this villain. What was Sasha Cohen's crime? She had brushed up against Michelle a couple of times during practices. I think the story might have been taken further had there not been the scandal of the judging in the pairs competition. Finally, there is the story which I think ended up predominating. Would Michelle have her coronation, or would yet another teenager knock her off her throne and keep her from winning the great prize?
Abigail, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Abigail Federkane is probably the world's expert on media coverage of Olympic figure skating.
Americans may admire the physical discipline of figure skating, but increasingly they're doing yoga, a physical and spiritual practice born in India roughly 5,000 years ago. Yoga was brought here 140 years ago, and some would say it's taken that long to become hip in America, and just a little bit longer to become a marketing tool. Rachel Miro reports from KPCC in Los Angeles.
Stephen Powers has been doing yoga for 2 years now. The president of M&K Sound, an audio equipment company, added the discipline to his fitness regimen after he spotted a class one Saturday morning on the beach in Venice, California. When M&K began developing a new ad campaign for its speakers, Powers thought it only natural to recommend his yoga teacher, Andrea Brooke.
What are the qualities that a person like Andrea or any talented yogi has? Balance, power, focus, clarity.
For years, M&K's advertising has relied on the company's relationship with big-name customers like George Lucas of Star Wars. In recent months, Powers and his advertising director decided to try a new tack. The concept is still in development, but when all is said and done, potential customers will flip a magazine page to find Andrea Brooke assuming a dramatic asana, poised in the presence of M&K speakers.
We want to kind of communicate about our speakers, that they're not average, they're not run-of-the-mill, we're very much the high end. You know, many people don't hear the difference, or they're not that interested in music to go out and spend thousands of dollars on a pair of speakers.
While Powers professes to be out of touch with Madison Avenue, he's intuitively hit on a happening trend. Yoga imagery is everywhere, lending its limber, spiritual veneer to Nike shoes, breakfast cereal, even internet stockbrokers like Ameritrade. Whether it's SUVs or underwear, advertisers know yoga doesn't just stretch, it sells. Moreover, it sells to the right people. Carrie Hollenberg, an expert in what makes consumers tick at SRI Consulting in the Bay Area, calls them actualizers.
These are people that tend to be leaders in society. They tend to be quite sophisticated. They value independence, they have a lot of self-confidence. They're quite active in their day-to-day life. They're generally quite technologically savvy. They travel. They're appreciative of other cultures.
While actualizers haven't elbowed out the patchouli-scented hippies of yoga in years past, they have changed the face of the practice here in the U.S. Consider, for example, the ultimate actualizer, Madonna, who even played a yoga instructor in The Next Best Thing.
Hands together in prayer position, feet together. Namaste.
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 Namaste. Oh.
Go to the right class in L.A. or New York, and you just might lunge into Chaturanga a couple mats over from Christy Turlington or Shaquille O'Neal. Surveys find roughly 20 million Americans have tried yoga. A practice that big is bound to pull in some people who, even if only unconsciously, just want to be hip as opposed to arrived. Andrea Brooke, the yoga teacher from the M&K ad, admits she's seen some pretty silly stuff in the 6.5 years she's been teaching.
That hipness where, you know, where we're focusing on what am I going to wear to yoga, what am I going to drive to yoga, you know, people are racing down the street, honking and yelling and screaming and flipping people off so that they can get to yoga. That's the part that cracks me up the most.
But whether they get it or they don't, Brooke figures anything that exposes people to yoga is a good thing, because yoga is a good thing.
I love the idea of using yoga in advertising because it makes people think, oh, I want to do that. And I do see yoga as a lifestyle, and it profoundly affects people's life and the choices that they make and how they feel about themselves.
But is yoga in the service of selling products really yoga? Ann Cushman, a contributing editor for Yoga Journal, explains followers are clearly admonished not to fall prey to the myriad delusions of materialism and greed.
Yoga really asks us to look at what actually makes us happy. And if we really investigate, we see pretty clearly that having more things does not bring us any real, lasting, sustained happiness. Whereas the whole premise of advertising is exactly the opposite.
That said, Cushman doesn't believe advertisers are using yoga as anything more than a superficial backdrop.
For instance, if you see a car ad with a picture of a gorgeous young woman in downward facing dog, they're actually not trying to sell the car through yoga. They're trying to sell the car the way they try and sell everything, which is by associating it with a young, beautiful, fit person doing something sort of hip.
Proving that on Madison Avenue, certain principles hold true forever. Whereas achieving the perfect sculpted butt through yoga is an elusive and ultimately transitory state of grace. For On the Media, I'm Rachel Miro in Los Angeles.
This week, we learned that Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl was killed by his captors in Pakistan. From all we've heard, Pearl was the best kind of reporter, a committed and compassionate exposer and explainer, lately applying his skill to the people who call us, whom we call, the enemy. In this case, he was seeking information about emails exchanged by Pakistani militants and Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber. Pearl's was just one of 100 stories by 100 reporters that add vital pieces to the puzzle of our place in the world, the challenges we face. It's hard to do. We owe him our grief and our gratitude. And this week we mark another passing. Newsman Howard K. Smith died of pneumonia and heart failure at the age of 87. He hadn't been on the air for more than 20 years, but people still remember him for his opinions, his prickliness, and his principles.
The sunny Southland this year shivered under the icy hand of a crisis in civil rights, a crisis which pitted neighbor against neighbor and which seriously threatened to undermine our posture abroad as the champions of liberty.
That was Smith in a 1957 radio report about the fight over school integration in Little Rock. You'll notice he passes judgment in the very first sentence. In a later report on civil rights, he concluded with a quote from Edmund Burke that, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." That quote, condemned as editorializing by his CBS bosses, was dropped, and ultimately, so was Smith. The next year, he reemerged with his own show on ABC, analyzing the issues of the day. One segment, called The Political Obituary of Richard M. Nixon, included an interview with Alger Hiss, the alleged spy fingered by Nixon, prompting a torrent of angry letters. Smith replied that he'd put a prostitute on the show if she played an important role in history. 8 months later, the show was canceled. Smith next took up residence on the anchor desk at ABC Evening News, but after some years was demoted to commentator. Then his commentaries were dumped, and he left the business in 1978 at the age of 65.
During the Second World War, Smith began his career as one of Edward R. Murrow's hand-picked recruits, a team that would set the standard for broadcast news. Smith was marked then and ever after as one of Murrow's boys. But as television grew up, boys like Smith grew old and disapproving. The man who infuriated viewers with his forthright views on integration and Richard Nixon became infuriated in turn with what he deemed TV's liberal bias. He wanted television to reflect his own convictions, and in that he is no different from any other viewer. Inevitably, TV reflects the people who produce it, a varied lot, but not necessarily the mirror of America. So tension between the nation and its news reporters is inevitable and appropriate. The anger reporters can inspire, justified or not, is instructive, and passion can be a spur to progress. Howard K. Smith once said, "A dull and cautious editorial or a strong one on a banal issue are of no help to anyone." He said editorials, but he editorialized in his reports as well. Passion in work is always risky. More than one journalist has lost his credibility or, like Smith, his job. Sometimes, as in the case of Daniel Pearl, the loss is incalculable.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price and Katya Rogers with Sean Landis, engineered by Irene Trudell, Dylan Keefe, and George Wellington, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Andy Lancet, Jim Colgan, and Kathleen Horan. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Mike Pesca is our producer at large, Arun Roth, our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from National Public Radio. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Ford Foundation, the Bydell Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.